Welcome to Idle Red Hands, a podcast from Japan about gaming and gamer life. And welcome to Idle Red Hands. I'm Chris.
I'm Wayne.
And that's it.
Yep, no Lyle this time.
Which is a rare thing. He's usually on.
Yeah, I think we calculated it out and it was more of a rare occurrence when I wasn't here.
Yeah, you're the one who's always here. I'm the one who's always gone, and Lyle's. Yeah. So, I finally got around to, well, it's not a finally, because it's been a fairly recent release. I watched The Hunger Games 2.
You didn't like Hunger Games 1 all that much, did you? Or you at least posted that YouTube thing about the problems with the first one.
Oh, yeah, well, it's one of those everything wrong with movie X. It's a kind of a series on YouTube, but I always find those funny anyway, even if it's a good or a bad movie. You know, actually, that's something that I wanted to bring up about it. The problem that I had with Hunger Games 1 was solved by Hunger Games 2, actually.
Well, oh, really?
Partially. Okay.
Well, I guess we can't really do spoilers because it hasn't been out for that long, but.
Yeah. Well, okay. The thing is, like, in the Hunger Games 1, the basic idea of the Hunger Games is that it's a gladiatorial combat between, the different zones to, you know, placate the population and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, I thought it was a bit more of the capitalists forcing these districts to do this to remind them that, hey, we have ultimate power of life and death over the you guys. So,
So the kind of the thing is, oh, well, I suppose that fits into it. Anyway, the idea was that all the tributes from these different areas, they go to the capital and they fight in basically a gladiatorial type arena. But one of the things that didn't make sense to me is that during the games, they have these situations where the arena is kind of like a big holodeck thing. But they'll generate like these computer animated dogs that'll come and eat people, or like flames will shoot out of places. You know, it's just weird environmental effects that are also deadly, which didn't really seem to make sense to me, because the whole idea is pitting the different groups against each other, and there can only be one winner who's, you know, lauded with riches, blah blah blah.
Right.
So I don't know, that kind of bugged me about the first one. But that said, in the second one, it made more sense. I don't want to actually give away what the trick was, but imagine if it was like all of the different monsters and, you know, fire shooting out of places and all the different weird effects, if they followed certain rules, like maybe the movement of a chessboard or something like that. That's not in the movie, but it's kind of that idea, so, in which the players in the game can figure it out and overcome. So it is more like a game in that sense. So, yeah.
Yeah, however, you haven't read the books.
I have not, no.
I lent them to Lyle, and he's read all of them. Mm-hmm. For some reason, I didn't finish number 3. Like, I started, got a couple pages, and not that I lost interest, but something else came up, and I have to go back and read it. So I have not read book 3. Mm-hmm. But in book 1, we never saw any of the behind-the-scenes stuff about how the game was manipulated.
Huh.
Like, we got the sense that it was being manipulated, and we got the sense that there were, you know, any number of different arenas where anything could happen, and that things were specifically being shaped so that they were, you know, deadly and all this stuff. But we never saw how that happened.
Huh.
And I know they had to do it for the movie, so it didn't bother me, because, again, we got the sense that the capital had vastly superior technology that they were not sharing with the other districts.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I know that part bothered you, where, you know, they had the scene of the lady, like, dropping in the tree, or, you know, them doing all this stuff. But that didn't bother me, only because I kind of knew it was there. It just hadn't been as overt in the book.
Okay. Yeah, it's not so much that it bothered me, per se. It's just that it didn't make sense. The idea of, again, the gladiatorial thing versus, you know, just trying to kill people.
Right.
It just didn't make sense. You know, if for example, the audience, which is huge, it's the most popular game, if the audience sees their favorite character die because, I don't know, a tree falls over on top of them, when it's known that the dome is generated so that the tree would fallen then on purpose, it just doesn't make sense. You know, that wouldn't make people happy. So
no, but I mean, come on, it's like We're looking at it from something like
that makes sense.
Yeah, we're looking at it from something that makes sense. We're looking at it from like Survivor, where you know they can't kill people on TV. Where in this one they do. They're ancient Roman gladiators doing stuff. And again, not to give stuff away, but in the first movie, the manipulation they did was more to obviously to get people so where they would come into conflict with each other.
Right. Like, exactly.
Because that's what you want to see. Like you want to see the people fighting.
That's what made me confused about it, because the first movie, I suppose it's been out long enough, it's not that big a spoiler, so the main character, Katniss, is walking too far away to the edge of the arena, and so they want to push her back, so they start a forest fire that would push her back, which, of course, is totally cool, that makes perfect sense, but the forest fire isn't just a forest fire, it's like shooting balls of fire at her, you know? She has to dodge out of the way of explosions and things, and she nearly dies, and it's kind of, if the purpose is to push her forward, why do you nearly kill her?
Because it's a movie and it had to be exciting.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I understand that part, but it's also kind of,
well, again, not to keep saying it, but the book was just a forest fire to push her back over there. Mm. So, you know. Correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but I think you were kind of disappointed at the end of Hunger Games, where it was just like, oh, a dog. Or a pack of dogs. Or that was kind of the thing in that little video. Mm-hmm. But, again, like, I guess getting back to Hunger Games 2, I thought the second movie did a really good job of getting the themes of the book across, and like, it was compacted because it has to be an hour and a half. Yeah. But I don't know, I kind of thought they lost a few things for the first one. One of them being, okay, we don't know what happens to the bodies of fallen tributes. Mm-hmm. All we know is a hovercraft comes and scoops them up.
Right.
We know the Capitol has genetic manipulation technology. Mm-hmm. In the book, there was a dog for every fallen tribute, and the mutations had characteristics and colorations that very much resembled the fallen tributes.
I remember that, which is, I think, a really, really cool point and great for the book, but I think Lyle said it really well in the last time we talked about it, that, you know, it's just not feasible to put that kind of detail into the movie when it doesn't have enough weight on the plot.
True. It came across as being very horrific in the book. Because it was that ambiguity, and we don't know what they're doing with the bodies of these people. Mm-hmm.
It came across as kind of cheap in the movie, but I imagine if I had known the back story to it, then that would have been much cooler.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
But
anyway, you know, I'm complaining here, but it really is about minor points, and I did enjoy the movie overall.
Yeah, I thought the movie was pretty good. I liked it better than the first one.
That's good, yeah. Yeah, I think it was an improvement on the first one as well. And, besides that, the book is, of course, even better. I haven't read it myself, but every person I've talked to who has read it loved it. So if anybody out there is looking for a good read and hasn't yet, go for Hunger Games.
Well, not to speak for Lyle, but he kind of was done for the book, or was done with the book by the time he finished number 3.
Huh, last time we talked about it, he was heaping praise on it.
Don't know if that was book 3, but, okay, no secret, they go back to the arena in 2. Uh-huh. And I'm kind of wondering if that happens in book 3.
I wonder, because they kind of...
Yeah.
we're getting into spoiler territory, so maybe we won't go there yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, it would have to be very contrived if they go back in book 3, and I'll say that. So
I don't see how they could justify it, but who knows? No,
they could.
Exactly. It's a movie. They can do what they want.
Exactly.
Dogs, sure, throw it in fire, whatever.
Exactly. Falling trees back in the arena. Yeah.
Sounds like one of my games, actually. Rocks fall.
Rocks fall. Everybody dies.
So, getting into games then. Today's topic.
Well, you came up with today's topic by finding an article.
Yeah, I think this is an article from a regular column for The Escapist Magazine, online at escapistmagazine.com. And there's a column on the theory of traditional tabletop RPGs called Check for Traps. And it is written by Alexander Macris, M-A-C-R-I-S, not sure I'm pronouncing that correct. And we'll also link the article in the post, in the show notes. But the article is called All About Alignment. It's from December 2010, and it is, well, all about alignment. It talks about the kind of traditional D&D idea of alignment, lawful versus chaotic, and crossed with good versus evil. And he kind of gets into a lot of pretty heavy philosophical stuff about it, but it's really interesting. And one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about it is because the way we play, since I've met you guys, I've been moving further away from using alignment in games, but this brings up some pretty interesting points that kind of made me rethink whether that's something I want to do or not.
Oh, have you been moving away from alignments because we think they're lame?
Well, yeah, actually. I mean, you guys, when we started with it, you know, I was straight up D&D, you know, I'd played all the different versions of D&D, but not much outside of that game. So, yeah, I never really gave alignment that much of a thought, but, you know, you guys brought up a lot of really good points about why alignment doesn't work in a lot of situations. And, I agree with them, so maybe we should recap them.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, well then, Wayne, what's your take on alignment? And please feel free to speak for Lyle, because he's not here.
Okay, sure. I don't know, like, I'm kind of in the same boat as you, where I didn't play that much outside of D&D, only because I didn't have that many people to play with. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I don't know. I think by the time we at least finish our 4E campaign, maybe even towards the middle of that, I was kind of done with epic fantasy. Uh-huh. And, of course, I like Lord of the Rings and all that stuff, but I don't know. I've found that the smaller scale things to me are more personally interesting. And the big, you know, good versus evil storylines, kind of like Lord of the Rings or other things, there's really prevalent in fantasy literature and media. Mm-hmm. I don't know, just didn't hold that much appeal for me. It was kind of like an episode of, or a season of 24, where, you know, the first one, they're deactivating nuclear bombs, and yeah. Then the second one, you're like, okay, well, where do you go from there?
Yeah.
Oh, we're saving the world again. So, not to say that it can't be done well, but then reading something like a Game of Thrones, where I guess there are clearly evil people in that series, but there's a lot of gray. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I find that more interesting, kind of trying to navigate that sea of gray.
It kind of doesn't actually get to white, huh? It has the evil people, it has the maybe evil people, and that's about as far as it goes, huh?
Yeah.
I think a lot of the games we've played, just the way we play, you know, we use a lot of morally ambiguous NPCs to because it kind of gives them a depth of character. You don't meet this person and right away know what they are or what their, for lack of a better term, alignment is, be it with different groups around the world or with actually good versus evil. So it can generate a lot of depth and mystery to NPCs, to monsters too, for that matter.
Hmm.
And we, not so as much for myself as for you guys, and this is a big compliment to you, is you guys often bring up difficult moral conundrums in your games. And, you know, they really make you wreck. Like, oh, what are we going to do?
But sometimes when they're not even intended, I don't think.
Exactly. I tried a couple on you, but I don't think they worked out as well.
Well,
but,
I think we made our own. Like, I'm thinking, again, I'm thinking of, like, the early 4E game we played where we're like, okay, this one guy in the village is a tiefling. Uh-huh. And there were footprints or something that implicated the guy. And then I think we spent like a session and a half talking about racial profiling in character,
exactly.
about whether or not we had the right to go bust this guy's door down and question him just because he happened to be the same race as a suspected arsonist. I don't think you planned for that.
No. It was good fun. But yeah, I mean, those kinds of situations, they are really interesting to delve into. But, so that's the reasons that kind of I'd been moving away from it personally. And I don't know if you were ever into it that much when you played back in the day, were you? Into the good versus evil.
It was hard to say. I mean, well, some types of games, it works better than others. And let's be honest, sometimes you just want to like roll dice and kill stuff. And then the big capital G good and the big capital E evil, is kind of useful justification for why you're doing that.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think, they said it in the article is, what was it, if Sauron and Aragorn, you know, if they were morally ambiguous questions, the story just wouldn't be what it was, you know?
Right, and I completely agree.
Yeah.
So.
And that's actually specifically the thing that the article mentioned that got me thinking about this, is that if you get rid of kind of the stark contrast between good and evil, then you're kind of dumping that theme, which is a humongous theme in so many different kinds of stories. So. And it's not to say that you can't use it, but again, the example of Lord of the Rings, you know, if they're, both sides are the same, then it's a completely different story.
Right.
kind of loses a bit of epicness.
Hmm.
Well, I should have mentioned before, but for today's episode, we're going to be breaking it down into four different parts, which kind of go with the article. The first was a discussion of the thematic idea of good versus evil, which we kind of just burst through. We all raring to get to it.
There's a little more there.
The second and third parts are actually going with the D&D definition of alignment, which is the law versus chaos scale, and then beyond that, the good versus evil scale and the way that the article defines them. And then finally we'll get into kind of a first person, third person view of how people would define themselves, and sidebar to that is what Wayne doesn't like about this idea.
Right, because you can't have an episode without me complaining about something.
More power to you.
Right. But now, as you were saying, in terms of like the thematic thing, ditching the good versus evil themes, for lack of a better term, well-chosen section header. in certain types of games, yeah, you would lose something. I mean, the big one is Lord of the Rings, because, yeah, if the sides were the same, then the story would not be as epic as it was. You're probably going to bring up Star Wars, since that's our kind of go-to movie as well. And again, yeah, the Empire is evil. The Jedi are good. It makes for a very epic story. So, right. I'm not saying that every game should have this taken out, because it is kind of the driving force for a lot of games, D&D especially. Because I think D&D does the heroic, gotta save the world, theme maybe more than other games.
Right.
Just because that's kind of what it is.
Okay, yes, I agree.
Okay.
Well, you know, you're right, absolutely, that good versus evil is a big part of the fantasy genre, and of course D&D there, but, you know, I think it's present in a lot of other games. I mean, for an example, the games that we've played, the people who we usually fight against, they are bad. I mean, there's usually very little redeeming, characteristics to them. You know, be it a big evil corporation or a big evil group of vampires bent on taking over the world. We play the good guys. We play heroes. Even if we're not, you know, the Dudley Do-Right type of hero, we still play people who are, you know, trying to save other people. So, you know, we may deal with kind of more morally ambiguous themes, but I don't know. I think the good versus evil dichotomy is a big part of many games. And as an example, Vampire. Or, for that matter, all of World of Darkness. You know, you tend to think of that as kind of a game that deals more with the grays. But in a sense, their humanity scale is almost more strict than the D&D scale. In that D&D, you kind of have this gradation, an axis of law versus chaos and then good versus evil. So you can place yourself in a lot of different arrangements on that. For example, the Empire in Star Wars is lawful evil. So they follow the laws, but they are evil. But the humanity scale in Vampire is kind of only back and forth. You know, killing people is wrong. You know, there is no moral justification for it. For example, this person was evil, therefore it is okay to kill them. This is a complaint that I've had for a while about it. The humanity scale is very kind of Western, Judeo-Christian based morality, which is, of course, fine, and it's a real system of morality, one that I think is quite good, but I don't think it tends to fit everybody, especially, you know, things like vampires, which kill people on a regular basis.
Right. Well, and it's interesting. I certainly agree that it's kind of a Judeo-Christian view, but like in the article we're discussing, the ideas of good and evil are pretty much the Judeo-Christian version as well. I think there's a really good section where the author says, okay, look at something like the Iliad or the Odyssey. And the quote-unquote heroes are psychopaths.
Right.
But I guess the argument is, at the time those were written, the concepts of being strong, healthy, wealthy, and powerful were seen as being good, while the qualities of being like weak, sick, poor, and pathetic were negative and kind of seen as being evil. So in one sense, these psychopaths from the Iliad and the Odyssey are embodying positive traits, despite them being murderers and killing lots of people.
Right, right.
So I don't enti- entirely agree with you saying that the vampire or the old vampire morality scale is kind of a Judeo-Christian thing, because the D&D dual alignment axis thing is as well.
Well, I don't know. The D&D dual axis alignment is written from the perspective of Judeo-Christian, but I don't think that it aligns with those morals.
Why not?
Okay, well, as an example, lawful is, if you're thinking in the, again, the Judeo-Christian kind of tradition, lawful is good, following the, especially in the Christian, in the religious sense of Judeo and Christian part of it, you know, following these precepts set down by a god is the, following these laws, you are lawful and that is a good thing, you know, the good versus evil part of it taken out of it. However, D&D allows you a lot of latitude within that to say, again, the example of the Empire in Star Wars. They are a lawful society. They follow strict code, but they are also an evil society. And also, if you get into the religious thing of it, there's lots of different gods represented in D&D. An evil god will have his set of guidelines. You can be lawful and still follow those guidelines. So even though it's written where lawful is something, quote-unquote, good, it doesn't actually have to be good.
True. And I think... I know what you're saying, but I think I kind of disagree a little bit, where if you're comparing, like, the vampire morality scale, there's only one scale.
Mm, yes.
Whereas the D&D alignment thing is, if you look at just being lawful, just neutral, or just chaotic, they've stripped out the good or bad aspect of that, which is why there's the secondary axis that you can move along. So, I don't... Okay, well... From our perspective, following the laws as opposed to disobeying the laws is generally considered a good thing. However, we also kind of make exceptions when we can say, okay, these laws are completely unjust, and yeah, sometimes the end justifies the means, right? But I see what you're saying, where for the most part, following laws is considered to be like a quote-unquote good thing.
Right.
Maybe this gets into... you know, kind of the last part we were going to discuss, where I didn't really like alignment all that much, but I actually like the old world, the new world of darkness.
Should we say medium world of darkness?
Yeah, the slightly
pre-Strix.
Old new world of darkness. Yes, the pre-Strix, the pre-God Machine Chronicles morality scale. Because it does have those very strict sins, they call them, kind of those strict levels, where... The D&D alignment system is very malleable, and it can mean different things to different people. And so it was, I'm not going to say useless, but it was less useful to me than the New World of Darkness one, where it kind of said, and one of the criticisms we discussed in the God Machine Chronicles review, people said that the morality scale was actually... or had nothing to do with the character's internal morality. It was the kind of society's perception of how moral you were.
Right.
Which I didn't have a problem with.
Mm-hmm.
For right or wrong, I tend to think that a game set in the World of Darkness is probably going to stay around one area.
Yeah.
Where that's not to say like a D&D campaign can't. But I know a lot of fantasy campaigns have kind of like, oh, this is the lawful evil kingdom. This is the, you know, neutral good kingdom, whatever.
Yeah.
And all those different viewpoints kind of make the alignment, I don't know, not that useful, because you're going to have lots of different types of people looking at it, where in a World of Darkness game, you can generally say, okay, this is the society the game takes place in. Everyone... or not everyone, but the majority of the society is going to follow these rules and see these things as, you know, heinous or whatever. And so it was a bit more concrete and a bit more useful for me.
You know, I absolutely agree. I totally agree. I think the specific examples of what are sins, what are bad things in the World of Darkness humanity morality scale, that I think, yes, that gives a clear picture of what alignment is, what it means, and how to use it in this game. So in that sense, it is great. However, I think that the leeway which allows you to define the morality of a society or of certain characters within that society in the D&D system is one of its strengths, despite how many arguments it caused. But you're absolutely right. The vagaries in that caused a lot of problems. I don't think there's any other rule in D&D that probably has caused as many arguments for myself or really anybody else out there.
Yeah, probably not. I mean, I'm sure there's some mechanic that's caused lots of problems, but
grappling.
Oh yeah, grappling.
But no, that actually gets into the second part that we wanted to talk about. Is in this article all about alignment, the author goes and characterizes his definitions of law versus chaos and good versus evil, which I think are extremely workable and could make a lot of sense and be a really useful tool in a game.
Yes. Yes.
And those three are, whipping out the big words here, deontological, consequentialist, or artological. And deontological is rules-based, where the ends do not justify the means. You are to follow the means, the laws. Consequentialist is the results-based, where the ends do justify the means. As long as you get the intended ending, then however you got there is okay. And artological is where it's character-based. As long as your intention is for lack of a better word, good, then the means can justify the ends or vice versa.
Right. No, and I thought you had really good examples where, you know, deontological is essentially the Ten Commandments, right? And what's written is what you should follow regardless of circumstances or any other factors, right?
Right.
Like he says, one of the commandments is thou shalt not steal, mm-hmm. period. Doesn't matter why you are stealing.
Exactly.
If you break this law, well, you should be punished.
Exactly.
Whereas the consequentialist says so long as your results are good, you're a good person. And the kind of person that pops into mind is Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was breaking the law for the betterment of other people.
Right.
Then he said artological, the character-based ethics, that kind of philosophy believes that you can't really know the consequences of your actions.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's impossible to judge something based on the results that somebody gets.
Exactly.
Instead, you just kind of look at what motivated the person to act that way. And then you can kind of judge whether or not that was a good or evil act.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the author points out that those map very nicely to lawful, neutral, and chaotic,
mm-hmm.
to use the D&D law axis. So, I completely agree, yeah.
Yeah, and I think this, defining it in this way would be really, really useful for building NPCs, because, you know what the laws are in the society you're doing, and you can just write it down, you know, lawful, neutral, chaotic, or, yeah, I'm gonna go with those because the other words are too long for me.
Right, right.
Then you just know, you know, if this NPC says lawful, then I know what the laws are and he's going to follow them regardless. Versus, you know, the other two where they might disregard the laws completely or consider the, what they want to happen. So, yeah, I think this would be a fantastic tool for defining NPCs and monsters for that matter.
Yeah. No, and again, the author sums up that section with a really good example. If you ponder whether or not you should drive through a stoplight when no one's around to witness you, he says, just by thinking that, you are neutral.
Right.
Because he says the lawful person would not have considered doing that and would have stopped because not stopping at a stop sign is breaking the law. Where he says a chaotic person would not have questioned whether or not he should stop. They just would have continued to go through when they knew it was safe.
Right.
And I thought that was a really good little section that helped clarify that.
Yeah. And I think also the kind of little catch at the end of the chaotic person, as soon as he knew it was safe too. You know, chaotic doesn't mean actually chaos in this sense. It means someone who just cares about what the situation is and what's going to happen, and they just don't care what the rules are.
Right. The results are I am not going to get hit, therefore I will do this thing.
Mm.
Yeah. No, and using that to characterize NPCs in a game would be very useful.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the problem for me with the lawful, chaotic, and neutral, and I'm sure this has been discussed on other podcasts and other places, is especially in a fantasy setting, or a science fiction setting, I imagine the laws of any one particular place can change pretty frequently.
Right.
So
whose laws?
Yeah, exactly. Whose laws do you follow?
And that gets in kind of to the second part about good versus evil, the second axis of the D&D morality scale, alignment scale. That's it. Yes. The way that the author described good versus evil was circles of altruism, I guess, in that someone who is good has a very large circle. So this circle means who I consider to be worthwhile, who I consider to be good, who I want to protect, who I want to help out. So a good character would have a very wide circle that would include himself, his family, his friends, maybe his entire society, maybe all things alive, maybe all good things and not any evil things.
Right.
Yeah, a wide circle. Whereas an evil person would probably have a smaller circle, maybe only himself and his friends and organization, or in an extreme sense, maybe just himself.
Right.
Yeah, so selfish versus altruistic, I guess, would be a better way of defining it.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. So what did you think of that?
I thought that was... It took me a second to kind of figure out what was going on, because in addition to there being these kind of different circles encompassing different groups of people for different types of people, the circles are also sloped. They're not flat. And that took me a while to get...
Yeah, I didn't either.
Because a circle is flat. And I'm like, as soon as you slope it, then it kind of becomes something like a cone or something,
yeah.
You know? But the point was that within the circle, different groups of people can have a different value.
Mm-hmm.
Where the example he gives is a neutral character would have a medium-sized slope circle, with, you know, their closest friends and family being at the high end of the slope, and then, you know, it tapers off into kind of everyone else,
right.
Meaning they are less important.
Mm-hmm.
And a good example, or not a good example, but a good way to explain this is the Arab maxim, me against my brother and I against our cousin, my brother, my cousin, and I against a stranger.
Mm-hmm.
So... Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, all these people deserve protection, or I should try and help these people, but certain people take precedence over other people.
Exactly.
So, and I thought that was a really interesting and useful way to look at it, because then it doesn't make evil the, you know, mustache twirling, tie someone to the train tracks kind of, you know, Snidely Whiplash character being evil for evil's sake. It's just, nope, the circle of people that should benefit from my actions has exactly one person, and that person is me.
Yeah, yeah.
And the slope could be really extreme, where I am just standing alone on this circular pedestal, and everyone else is miles below me, because that's the type of person I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, they go all nihilistic on it.
Right.
But, yeah, you know, again, I think this is a really good way of defining a character, again, maybe for PCs, maybe for the players to help define the PCs for themselves, but very good for defining NPCs.
Hmm.
The downside to it is that, like with the law versus chaos, I think this can create a lot of work for the DM to try and list all of this person's in-groups and out-groups and who they care about and who they don't. So I think this is a good way to define and to think about good versus evil, especially if you're not going to have like a heaven versus hell, Sauron versus Middle Earth kind of dichotomy. I think it's a good way of looking at it, but it could also be difficult.
It could be if you feel you have to list everybody or list all these circles of people that the character wants to benefit. Yeah, because then every time your players meet an NPC, you are very quickly going to have to, or maybe not so quickly, going to have to figure out how big and who is in this person's circles,
right.
Which might not be that useful.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, it kind of gets away from the good versus evil thing, or it's a different interpretation.
Well, yeah. I think altruistic versus selfish is a better way to define it in this sense.
Right, which... I guess is one, certainly one way to look at it. But if you're doing the Lord of the Rings style good versus evil, then Sauron wasn't just selfish.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of the weakness. I don't think I explained myself better earlier. I think the weakness here is that it kind of ignores motivation and focuses only on what people are concerned about. You could have an evil character who is very loyal to their in-group. They have maybe an evil organization or something. So maybe they are quite altruistic, but there's a pretty stark line between who they consider good or bad. But besides that point, they would be evil because they are working to end the world. They are doing something that is considered quote-unquote evil. Same, on the opposite side of the situation, you could have your jerkbag paladin. You know, the only person they really care about in this, this adventuring party is themselves. They don't care about the thief or the fighter or anything like that. They're a lone thing. They are very selfish, but they are quote-unquote good. They are trying to save the world or the city or something like that. And maybe it's not because they want to help people. It's because they want to impress their god and gain more power.
Sounds pretty selfish to me.
Exactly. Extremely selfish, but also they are fighting for good. So, yeah. I mean, I suppose even if you asked me, I probably wouldn't say that person is a good person. But
right,
still,
right.
Yeah.
That sounds a lot like forced volunteerism.
Kind of, yeah, doesn't it? But, you know, I suppose this... It really depends on how you want to handle it in your game, is if you want to look at the end result or if you're looking at the motivation. I suppose it kind of goes back into what we were talking before.
Well, you mentioned, you brought up the fact that paladins, you know, can worship different gods, and I think that is one of the, maybe not sticking points, but it's both useful and it's also kind of a hindrance. That the gods are so prominent in a lot of D&D campaigns, because on the one hand, okay, you're going to have gods that embody the virtues of these different points on this morality scale, or this alignment scale. So you have examples that people can look to see what is lawful evil or chaotic evil or lawful good, because the idea is that kind of the gods embody those virtues so much that that's kind of why they are gods. But then on the flip side of that, kind of the negative is, does evil mean selfish when you have this lawful evil god walking around who is very much not selfish and is very evil in the sense of the capital E word? So, I don't know. I think using gods, especially in a D&D fantasy setting, kind of prevent some of the interpretation we've been talking about.
I agree. I think the sticking point here is that it's difficult to define what good and what evil is.
Right.
But in the situation of D&D, you have a definition. This god is good, so doing what they want is good. This god is evil, so doing what they want is evil.
Or if you want to break it down even kind of, not simplistically, but another way to do it is, hey, you flip up with the monster manual, and this race of humanoids, orcs, goblins, whatever, they are lawful evil, chaotic evil, neutral evil. Why? Just because they are.
Well, I've always looked at it as kind of the, it's kind of a trickle-down theory from the gods. Like, I always imagined that the gods, and actually I wanted to try this out in a game, though I haven't had the opportunity yet, where the gods are kind of enslaved to their alignment. A lawful good god can only act in a lawfully good way.
Right.
But, and then maybe a little bit down from that, they have their angels or their avatars or something who have a little bit more free will, but they still have to be primarily lawful good. And then maybe this god created humans, so humans are don't have anywhere near the power, but they have a lot more free will. And same thing, you know, this evil god created orcs, so orcs tend to be towards evil, but they don't have to be, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. So, okay. Yeah. I was thinking a bit more like, you know, Gnostic theory, where, you know, the ultimate god is pretty much perfect, and throughout all the different spheres, things slowly get less perfect until you get us, and the corrupting factor is kind of free will. But I can see the trickle-down effect you're talking about where, you know...
It's just another way of looking at it. And again, that kind of gets to the root of the problem is there different people have different ways of looking at good versus evil, and that can muddy the waters.
Right. Part of the reason why I think the alignment, as found in kind of normal D&D, this axis we've been talking about, isn't that useful is... Specifically because it can be interpreted different ways by different people, even at the same table. And the article we've been talking about ends with, I thought, a really good section about different alignments would interpret this scale in different ways. And he writes that chaotic evil societies would probably have or rewrite the good-evil axis as unreasonable-reasonable, and the law-chaos axis as dogmatic-pragmatic.
Right.
And he says a lawful evil society would maybe look at good at evil as slavish and masterful because it's kind of negative to be subservient to somewhere else, while it's positive to be your own master. And the law chaos thing is honorable, dishonorable. So that was really interesting, and I like the different ways to look at it. But because it can be looked at in so many different ways, it kind of made me wonder how useful of a tool alignment was. And the fact that this article was written, maybe not specifically, but part of the reason it was written is because, as we said, alignment has caused a lot of arguments and problems.
Mm-hmm.
So again, if it kind of has to be clarified, how useful of a tool is it at the gaming table? I don't know.
Well, I'll read it what I said before. I think that it is very useful, especially when using the definitions that this author provides, in defining a structure to a character, and this can be for a player character or for an NPC, because with just one word, lawful, neutral, chaotic, you can get a really good sense of how they will act in most situations, assuming you know what their rules or their societal rules are. And I think that's really useful. Plus, it gets you into thinking about what the rules are going to be. And I think that's a way that you could work this into character creation. When somebody writes down that first part of their alignment, lawful, neutral, chaotic, ask them what system they follow. Do they follow the laws of the society, and then you can discuss what those laws are? Or is it a personal code of honor, or is it their religious code? Something like that. And I think it could be very useful for building characters, and for the GM as well, for building NPCs, you know? Write down which one they are and which set of laws they follow. Or don't follow, for that matter.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I've been looking at other game systems. You're definitely right, where having these six words as shorthand for a character's personality and what the core of their character is really useful. And they're good starting points for building a character. I don't know. I think I prefer other systems. Again, I've been reading Cortex Plus, and the dramatic role-playing. You're supposed to come up with five values, and those could be things like love, honor, respect, justice, fairness, beauty, whatever. You can change them for the type of game you're playing. And then all of the players have to write a value statement about how their character relates to each of those five values.
Well, that's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool, because you can use the name of the value in your statement, or you can like write a statement about how you just kind of deal with that or interact with that value. Like, if justice is one of the things that's chosen, it could be something like, I have no use for your justice system.
Mm-hmm.
That could be the statement for the character. And I don't know, I kind of like those better, although it certainly is, or it certainly does take longer to do than picking two of those six words.
Exactly, yeah. I, like I was saying, I think it's a really good toolbox to have this kind of alignment system, but I agree with you, I prefer the open setting, and which is one of the reasons I was so positive towards the new humanity system in the new World of Darkness.
Right.
Yeah. Where you define it for yourself. So, yeah, I totally agree with that. But I think, especially speaking from the GM side of the screen, I think a really nice, quick way to define a character's behavior is really something worth using. And I think for myself, I'm probably going to use this definition of lawful, neutral, and chaotic going forward. Good and evil, I don't know, I think that one gets more into the kind of game you want to play. If you want to play the where good versus evil is a theme, you should include that, and as you said before, like a capital G good, a capital E evil. But otherwise, you kind of have to worry about what the definition of good and evil is, because it's not going to be a big top-down definition.
Right.
Which can get you into those morally ambiguous situations, which are also a lot of fun to play with.
Yeah, I think talking about this episode has helped me codify that. It's not that I'm against the big, or the capital G good versus capital E evil types of games. It's just that they seem a bit easy. We're doing this because it's good, and we're fighting them because they are evil, and we kind of know what we have to do, and we kind of know where the line between those two things are, where I think it's more fun in a game, especially when I'm, like, running, or I guess when I'm playing either, is to see how far the characters and players will go to do certain things, where it's like, okay, yeah, are you going to do that? Or here's, like, a, as you said, a really kind of heinous moral dilemma in front of you, and are you going to try and work within the system to fix it, or go outside?
Yeah, you're right. It is easy, but of course it's easy because that's not really a question that the characters have to deal with.
Right, right.
So, yeah. When it comes down to it, I kind of agree. I've always liked The Hobbit more than I did The Lord of the Rings. And I think a part of the reason for that is that it is more vague as far as what the morals are. I mean, Thorin, is he a good guy or a bad guy? Bilbo, he's a burglar, but he's also on the good side, you know? Gandalf the Grey. I think the story in The Hobbit is actually deeper than Lord of the Rings, to be honest.
Well, Gandalf's pretty easy for me because I've read The Silmarillion and The Lord of the Rings. So you kind of know where he is on that.
But at the point when I first read The Hobbit and it was only The Hobbit, like, I didn't know. But anyway, yeah.
That's not to say that, again, not to say that The Lord of the Rings is boring, because we have very clear delineations of what's good and evil.
Right,
it's just
right.
The story isn't about those moral dilemmas. It's about
perseverance against evil.
Yeah, yeah. So if your game is about that, then it's probably better to have clearly defined good and evil sides. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Great.
Hey, we agree, and here we thought we were going to spend the whole hour disagreeing.
Yeah, for the audience out there, Wayne and I send emails back and forth often, and we do nothing but fight all day long.
I know.
I didn't expect to agree with you this much.
Yeah, maybe the problem is we usually get all our fighting out before we then go on the cast.
Could be. Next time we do a cast together, we just shouldn't talk to each other for a month and then see what happens.
Cage match!
I hate you!
Cool.
All right, well, thank you for joining us again on Out of Red Hands. Check us out online at www.idlereredhands.com, outofredhands.com. You can listen to the episode right there on the website, or stream it through iTunes or Stitcher, or download it off of DriveThruRPG. You can plus one us on G+, you can like us on Facebook, you can follow us on Twitter, or you can join up and talk to us in our forums. Those are at idleredhands.com/forums, and are hosted by Happy Jacks. Thank you very much, guys. Or you can send us an email at info@idleredhands.com. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
Drive Through RPG. We average 9 new titles a day. That's over 60 a week. And we've got well over 15,000 RPG titles online right now. Drive Through RPG, the one true source for RPGs. We'll be right back.
Idle Red Hands, recorded in Kobe, Japan. See us online at www.idleredhands.com. Music provided by Tripod Jimmy, and the song was Roadkill. Hope you enjoyed it. See you next time.